Well, after Dick's talk about the migrations of Southern food, the migrations of Southerners, now we're going to segue into a talk about a place that is Southern in its people and food, but is outside the South, that being Chicago. Our speaker is Marvin Jones, and Marvin is a native of the Chicago area and is a chef who has cooked, it seems to me, just about everywhere around the nation. Some peregrinations about from New Orleans to Nashville as well. When we first started talking about Marvin as a presenter, Marvin was working on Martha's Vineyard, and he began to talk to me, and we exchanged emails about what he was cooking at that particular time. And at that particular time, he was doing braised buffalo, venison with beach plum sauce, chipotle black beans, a lobster clam bake, corn vinaigrette on fresh-caught striped bass, corn-crusted bluefish, but then, of course, he adds, and of course, gumbo and cornbread. So he's kind of, to my mind, a living embodiment of taking Southern food, seeing Southern food shared on the same plate with other ingredients. So in keeping with the theme that we are discussing this weekend, what happens when Southern food leaves the South, I present you Marvin Jones.
How you doing?
Hey.
This works pretty good. So I don't know where to start. It's a big, big subject. I got books. This is only one of books just on the migration. You know, thanks to Richard with the maps. This is a great introduction because the thing is, the reason you can track the African Americans is because they've yet to assimilate. And so there's a whole hours and hours of why that's the case. But there's, I could start in the middle because that's like the heyday and what they call the black metropolis. It's black metropolis because we had a whole city to ourselves inside the city. All the other groups kind of came in and after a generation got to leave. And we're there holding the bag. So in 1938, there's a book called The Black Metropolis. And in 1938, we had 145 restaurants in the Black Belt. And so, you know, I wish I could come here and talk like John T's book about all the little backwaters and side places with their little great offerings. But I'm sorry to say, they're mostly a disappointment. I told John I love that Ajax on the square with all the with all their great menu, and he said, "You think that's great? Oh, there's much better places than that." And I said, "Well, not in Chicago. I'm sorry." So you know, I got lots of anecdotes about places, and you know, first I could. Well, thank God he did the introduction about people coming from the Delta up the river. The first one of which, I guess, DuSable. Anybody ever heard of DuSable? No? Well, DuSable was a Creole of color who traveled up the Mississippi in the 1700s, and he was the first non-Indian settler, somewhere on the Chicago River, and he had a trading post there. And so I'm sure he was there with the Potawatomis with the first barbecue. I mean, I think the Indians were always barbecuing and putting animals on a stick over the... I'm not an expert in that subject, but I'm sure that that's, if you want to go back, get technical, that's the very beginning. Before, in the early 1800s, there was the runaway slaves and the and whatever free blacks. They migrated there and kind of mingled and were scattered around the town. There was no black belt then, and so we catered for the general public and until the great influx, which really happened between World War I and World War II. The war in Europe kind of slowed down the migration of immigrants, and so they had to fill that void with jobs for opportunities for people from the South. So if there was a white migration, I don't know how big it was, but I know the 50,000 black people came up between 1910 and 1920. And that was so overwhelming, town fathers, I guess, decided, we'll just contain this. And instead of sprawling, we didn't have the opportunity for the urban sprawl. The native, the old settlers, the first, white Chicagoans controlled all the good real estate along the lake, so we weren't going there, and we couldn't go west either, and so we ended up going straight down State Street until today. There's about a quarter million black people just on State Street between 22nd and 55th, and it's kind of sad. We could go into the politics and all that, which it's kind of depressing, but the point is, now today we have trends that are nationwide and worldwide, and they affect the food business in general. And so the little family restaurants that I found when I went back to Chicago to prepare for this presentation, they hadn't changed much. They just kind of got a little creakier and run down, and their clientele is aging, and their methods haven't changed. And I know just since I started cooking in the 70s, things have changed a lot. And a lot of times I feel old when I go somewhere and they say, "You're gonna what? You're gonna butcher? You're gonna cut your own chicken wings?" How old are you? We don't do that. We're not making stocks. We're not making soup. And so, things change. And now there's so many more prepared foods. And so there at Gladys's, they are doing things from scratch. There's a place that they're so old basically, restaurants are real estate. If you're renting, your days are numbered. You gotta own the real estate, and luckily Gladys's and Soul Queen, they own their real estate, and so they have a little margin for they don't have to be profit oriented as the new restaurants coming up, so they can still cook from scratch and keep the prices for the locals. And so, I grew up thinking that Southern cooking meant soul food. It's always meant soul food. I didn't know that they had. When I was a kid, I didn't know white people ate Southern cooking, and so it was a surprise to me, and it's I'm still being amazed that because, like I said, the European immigrants lasted in the city for only, you know, one generation till the kids lost the accent, and then they weren't interested in eating the old foods from the old country. The kids have peer pressure, and they don't want to talk funny or eat funny or do anything different. So now today in Chicago, there's so many neighborhoods. The back of the yards is the Irish neighborhoods, and you know, they took control of the city ever since. Finally, the new mayor Daley has moved from there, and because, well, when you fly into Chicago, you could see the Gold Coast, the Sears Tower, tallest building in the world, and then it just tapers off the high rises along the lake, and then, but when you look to the south, it's just like flat, and you see some projects, but there's no Gold Coast. And so when I was a kid, any address with an S in it was not worth much. North anything was always so much more status. So there's there were Polish neighborhoods, and of course there's a Chinatown, and but the black neighborhood is where all the black restaurants and all the southern cooking used to be. Now today, the trend is for these regional restaurants are becoming trendy, you know. So I don't know if anybody ever heard of, anybody see Forrest Gump? So this is the menu from Forrest Gump. They have the best address in Chicago, which is Navy Pier. And I can read some. I didn't duplicate this, but you know, it's based on shrimp, and so they have a lot of southern. You know, is a Dixie Fishwich Forrest and Lieutenant Dan had one every day. It's a southern fried mahi mahi sandwich with Louisiana remoulade sauce and Monterey Jack cheese. You like that, huh? Yeah. See, so this is what, you know, it's not a black thing anymore, although, you know, there's Bubba. And this is the southern, this is the state of the art, Dixie style baby back ribs. And from the crab pot at Mama Blue's, a mess of crab legs with secret recipe Cajun garlic. You know, so this is the state of the art. These guys are no ma and pa. They're a corporation. I don't know. Anybody know of any other ones? There's got to be more than just the one. There's one in New Orleans. Yeah. So that's the way of the world, you know. Speaking of New Orleans, I was a chef in New Orleans at a place Jack's Brewery, right over the Café Du Monde, and so that proves that it's all really about marketing. There's no way around it. This fellow, his name was Gust. And in New Orleans, everyone knows the name. The family owned Antoine's, oldest restaurant in the country. And but, you know, he named his restaurant. He wanted to have a restaurant that was going to last 100 years. I don't know. This is not Chicago, so I guess I should... I'm rambling, but it just proves that you know, it's about marketing and the product, price, place. You can't just say I got the best fried chicken and think you're gonna survive and last without you know, without marketing and having your real estate and having a corporation behind you and advertising and good management. And so that's the thing. To me, it's sad that what was the black cuisine you know, it's not really anymore. I didn't know that it wasn't. It never was. You know, it was always everybody down south. You know, eat Southern food, and now we see that it's not about Gladys's and about the ghetto and. So I guess it's a good thing for Southern food in a way that these multinationals or whoever is taking on the picking up the torch and carrying it. Now I got a couple other stories. Now here's the Soul Cafe. Anybody ever heard of the Soul Cafe in Chicago? So I went there, and there wasn't a black soul in there, either side, you know, behind the line or out on the floor or anything. But I guess I just take it personal. I don't know, but shucked oysters, fried sage leaves with tomato, tomatillo salsa. Soul vegetable terrine, layered grilled vegetables, pesto vinaigrette, grilled mango, jalapeno glazed jumbo shrimp, black bean salsa, sweet crab cakes with corn, tomato orange salsa, tomato ancho coulis, oven roasted fava beans, southern fried crispy quail over molasses, honey baked peaches and Vidalia onions, house-made Tabasco, smoked duck, roasted corn chalupas with aged goat cheese and avocado and salsa Guillermo, jerk chicken skewers with cilantro cucumber yogurt, crispy smoked salmon raviolis with goat cheese and jalapeno oven mustard, fried oysters with habanero tartar, soul Caesar with parm, croutons, fried anchovies, summer greens with sesame chicken, cashews, carrots, wonton chips, Asian vinaigrette, arugula with blue goat cheese, sun-dried tomatoes, black olives. Anyway, so when I went back to Chicago a couple of years ago after being away for years, I was going to do my own jazz brunch, as I had been to New Orleans for some years, and they had, you couldn't count the jazz brunches there. It seemed like a natural, the music and the food. So I found a place on the new restaurant row, West Randolph, which was the old market, vegetable market, and I found a place that had its own parking lot, and it was caught in a marketing dilemma, which they're all in that market, but it was right down the street from Oprah's studio, and so he was the oldest restaurant on the street. Now the new restaurants were $10 for the valet parking. I told this guy, your entrees are cheaper than they're paying to park down the street, and he had free parking, but he was in between. He was 35 years old. This restaurant had been there so long, and they used to feed the workers. So they were too expensive. They went up a dollar or two, so too expensive for the old market and too cheap for the new. And they weren't even open on Sunday and had this liquor license. And I almost did my own jazz brunch there, but then I met someone in a bar. And we got to talking, and he said, "Don't you want to work in a black restaurant? Don't you want to, you know, full time? What's this Sunday?" So I said, "All right, I'll come and check it out." And the place was called Honeysuckles. And I went out there, and it was 350 seats in the dining room, and it was beautiful. It was burgundy and walnut and the big exposed kitchen. With the glass all the length of the dining room, and the kitchen was all modern, brand new, and had a smoker big enough to drive into and walk in bigger than this room. I said, maybe I'm supposed to be here. Maybe I will. Maybe I should be working here. This is a good ego thing. So I went to work there, and they gave me this menu. And I knew deep down that it was a catering place. This was not, but they were still trying to get a liquor license, and so I went with it. But, you know, here was their ambitious menu. And they're in the neighborhoods way out, 10 miles from town. And they wanted to do, they said the reason this didn't work was because the chef wasn't right. But it's marketing. So these guys had salmon crab cake duo, spinach artichoke gratin, crawfish escargot tart, fried green tomatoes. Let's get to these entrees. They wanted to do black fettuccine, penne rigate, turkey lasagna, duck. So I said filet mignon, Alaskan crab cakes, lobster tail, lobster abadiada, So I said, well, let me see what happened. Give me the tapes. Let me see what you all sold last time. So it was like 90% catfish and fried chicken is what people really bought. And I said, well, you know, that's the best indication of what you're going to do next time. Why don't we put all this stuff here that you insist we have, why don't we put it on the chalkboard? And so, you know, if we want to do it and we have it, we don't have to have, you know, 100 pounds of filet and lobster and just laying around. So we could, and anyway, so no, got to be on the menu. You got to do this. And so I passed through there 2 years later, and it's still just the brunch and the catered parties. The guy, catering is so much better business, but it's not, he had a lot of friends in the basketball world and the football, and he wanted to invite them down, and it's not the same. Come on down to, got a good graduation, good wedding tonight. He wanted to be Mr. Restaurateur. So he's not doing well, but I don't know. They're underworld connect. Maybe it's up front. I don't know. But there's another place I worked, which she was a caterer, and she did really well catering. But, you know, she has that urge to be a restaurant too, because we have the problem of where to go. You know, that's the emotional side of the restaurant business is, you know, black people. That's why we did so well in the 30s and 40s before desegregation or before integration. Because, you know, we all knew we were going out. That's where we're going. I got to, even in the 20. This book was come out in the 20s, and they talk about the resorts, they called them, and they had speakeasies and Black and Tans. Anybody ever heard of Black and Tan Resort? I don't know if I should go there, but that is, so there's so many things involved, you know, there's the, and it's not just the profit. People, so this woman had Stacy Bone, and she wonders why people don't come there to eat the collard greens and fried chicken and red beans and rice. Now, someone opened up next door, and so it's in a nice neighborhood. So that's the problem. If I remember in Richard's presentation, he mentioned, you know, you might have to go into the black neighborhoods to find the southern food. And so I don't know when that it became, you know, taboo. I mean, I guess there was a time when that brings me back to the black and tans, because this is way back in the 20s, and it was a shocking thing that people were... It's under racial contacts of black and tans. The intimate association of Negroes and whites in the cabarets of the South Side has occasioned frequent and heated protests. Negro men are there seen with white women and white women with Negro men. Although mixed couples constitute somewhat less than 10% of the patronage, this mingling is used to characterize all of their associations there. These resorts, with their liquor selling and coarse and vulgar dancing, are highly dangerous to morals and establish law and order and a nuisance to the neighborhood in which they are located. They are used as amusement places, both by white couples living in other sections of the city and by Negro couples who live near them. In fact, although many of the resorts are patronized by an equal number of whites and Negroes, the actual mixed couples are few. The habitués of these resorts are usually of an irresponsible type of pleasure seekers, and frequently they are vicious and immoral. Newspapers and several of the civic agencies have violently criticized these places as a menace, but in their attacks, the emphasis has usually been shifted from the menace to morals, to that of arousing sentiment against the mingling of races. The police, on numbers of occasions, have been urged to close the places in which this form of association took place. In most cases, they have not done so, stating that their reason, although mingling was undesirable, there was no law prohibiting such contacts, and that evidence of violations of such laws as those concerning liquor selling and decency would be necessary to warrant their closing. So during 1920, the Negro press began a series of attacks on violations of law and against the immoral resorts in the Negro residence areas, including the so-called black and tan cabarets, some of which were the most notorious violators. This was followed by similar attacks from the white local newspapers. The emphasis on the white papers, however, was on the race mingling, an extract from one of the articles in a white paper is given. Lawless liquor, sensuous shimmy, solicitous sirens, wrangling waiters, and the tint of the racial rainbow, black and tan and white dancing, drinking, singing, early Sunday morning at the Pekin Cafe. Anyway, so they, early on, people did come to the South Side, but that was very early on, it's not anymore. So that was back in the day. So so now it's a new day, and this is the future. Joe's Crab Shack. Hey, you guys, I see the ad here. You know, I thought it was kind of, you know, they have the red beans and rice and the gumbo and the, so that's the new offer. Here's one, Redfish. Anybody heard of Redfish? They're in Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, Denver, San Diego. And they're right next to the House of Blues. I'm shocked. And so they're Louisiana egg rolls, fried chicken, smackdowns, Cajun fried calamari. I went there once, a friend was at the House of Blues, an artist in town, and so we went there. He was Jamaican, and the manager was Jamaican, and the etouffee came out, and it burned. I mean, it was just hot. And I told the manager, I said, "Hey, this etouffee, it's hot, boy." He said, "It's a Creole restaurant, it's a Cajun, please, you're in mine." I said, "Don't give me that crap, man. You should tell the chef. He'll be glad that somebody, you know, was telling him instead of going out and telling the people on the street." And so that's the problem. People, even Austin Leslie and Shay Zaline opened a place in Chicago, and the waiters didn't understand the food. So I got some fried oysters because they didn't have a po' boy. And then I said, "Now, go get me some French bread so I can do something." Right, I was going to get to that. They are doing so well, and that has lasted up since, you know, ever since. Because now the state of the art is takeout food, and they were always ahead of the game. And so there are barbecue barons and millionaires from barbecue. Yeah, I think Farmer Brown's, was that the name of that one? Yeah, this was up on the north side, Farmer Brown's. And they were from Mississippi, and they've been there for years and years and years. I don't know if they were there before. It's right in the middle of the Gold Coast and the housing projects. So I don't know if they were there first.
I was in Chicago not long ago, and I went to a place on the south side, and on the door lay written, "Baby Jean's Yazoo, Mississippi style soul food." It covered the entire door, but she was staking claim to her Mississippi food in the middle of Chicago, and this was plaster on her door. I went in, and the lady was serving rice for breakfast. She had salmon croquettes and rice for breakfast. She had grits, she had chess pie. She had everything, and this was she'd only opened, she told me, in the past 3 or 4 years, but she was still staking very much a claim to her southernness.
Right, and when I first went to Chicago, one of the things that was so extraordinary to me was the regionality of the city within the city. The Mississippi bars, they were from particular areas, and if you were from X place in Mississippi, you went to Y bar in Chicago, and they had everything except for newspaper. But,
no, that was before my time, yeah. Yeah, Ribs and Bibs. The barbecue places they are doing so great. That place, I grew up on Ribs and Bibs, and for years I never ate. That was my staple. Yeah, now they gave it a Texas flair, right? They had the Maverick Munches and the Pistol Burger, and it was like an LBJ type of thing. And, that's a barbecue place that is not in the ghetto. It's in right in the middle of the ghetto. There's the University of Chicago area and that's where another great place, Dixie Kitchen, is doing quite well, because people can go and get Southern food without going in. So that's a marketing bullseye home run every time when you, and it's working well. So there's the Chicken Shacks. They've been there since the turn of the century, and they're fantastic. It must be 100 Harold's Chicken Shacks. They're state of the art. But the part that's dying is the old sit-down, full-service thing, and that's a trend that's nationwide, and they're not growing as fast as the takeout segment. And so that's what, that's just the way it is. But, the Lems and Leon's, Leon Finney, when I was in Chicago, he stayed in my dad's condo building. He's driving in his Rolls Royce every day, and he's doing fantastic in real estate, and the Lems, Leon's, Ribs and Bibs, they're millionaires. That's the good news. Here's another one that Kenny's Ribs and Chicken. They have 10 locations now. That's the future. You can't just be a ma and pa, because the competition makes the margin so slim that to make money you got to have several outlets. But Yeah. What do you all think?
about these things. I know, sitting in the back, the two representatives from Heaven on 7. Which,
right.
To my mind, in the stomach, they do it as well or better than anybody in Chicago.
That's right. That's what I said. It's a home run. You can go downtown and eat Louisiana cooking. And so any questions?
Let's open it up for just a general discussion of kind of the food of the South when it ends up in a place like Chicago, and also the issues Marvin raised about restaurant interpretation of traditional home food. So y'all use it as a forum. Yes, ma'am. Please stand up and try to project so everybody can count.
Okay, I lived in Chicago for over 30 years, and I certainly don't claim to be an expert on Southern cooking, but I do think that there are very lively remnants of Southern cooking in the Delta migration in Chicago. It is a very segregated city, and so unfortunately, I don't think a lot of the white people in Chicago can take advantage, or feel that they can take advantage of it, but we still have, for example, Moo and Oink is the name of a big grocery
it's huge.
Store.
Huge.
They specialize in traditional cuts of meat, you know, and
wigglers and
right.
Listeners.
I think it's very possible. I know you haven't mentioned, and perhaps these are overly commercialized too, but Edna's and Army and Lou's, these have been bastions of sort of Southern.
I got the Army and Lou's menu right here.
And I even did the Army and Lou's. I was at Edna's, and I actually think John was there. There was a soul food conference, and Chicago, and it was a revelation to me, even having lived there for 30 years, because I went places that probably on my own, to your point, I wouldn't go because it still is in the neighborhood. But just one more point, and then I sit down. But in terms of the popularization of some of these chains or you know, corporate conglomerates that are owning restaurants, unfortunately, I don't think it's any more true of this kind of food than Mexican food. I used to teach Mexican food in the 80s, and then when they started opening up Mexican restaurants, I didn't recognize it. So, unfortunately, I think that's something that is happening everywhere as we globalize and homogenize. But I guess I would try to defend Chicago a little bit by saying I think it is possible to find very Southern food there, even if sometimes you have to make it yourself. I think
that's what you need. Anybody else? Yes, they have all 7 folks.
I met you at that gala at the Winter Garden a couple of years ago. Yeah, I love that gumbo.
We worked real hard our bread and butter is basic Cajun and Creole cuisine. And we worked really hard to use the indigenous products from New Orleans. We bring them up from New Orleans. And we have a lot of places, I think, in Chicago that they think they can make like a gumbo with Polish sausage and hot dogs. And those. That becomes a problem. And he was also talking about food in general, where people are taking, they sort of bastardize it. But we also do a fusion cuisine as well. I hate to use the word fusion, but we'll take something like, for example, we have a large Hispanic population that works for us. So we take some crawfish and they've come up and they're famous for their tamales. So we have this crawfish tamale and it does extremely well. People love it. And we use the basic method in New Orleans. We find that to be something that some people want. And then there's a lot of people on the older side, I think, that they don't want to lose their traditions of Southern food. They want their collard greens, their red beans and rice, their hop and jam. And we offer that as well, and we do the best we can with that. But I find it very interesting that they're very protective of the Southern culture, and that's what I find very interesting.
Who's your clientele?
All right.
I'll give a very mixed clientele. The restaurant that I work at is right off of Michigan Avenue, and not only do we get a lot of tourists, but we also have a lot of locals, businessmen, both black and white. So I would say it's a very mixed one, though. And I would say they're very dedicated to it. They come back and keep coming back.
Who else has something to say? Kimberly?
You mentioned that when you were growing up, you didn't know that other than black people, soul food. Do you think soul food and Southern food are synonymous? Are they the same thing for you? And I'm going to ask how old you are, but how old are you?
I'm old.
That
played
a role in thinking that soul food is something that only black people ate in
Southside of Chicago. Maybe everybody goes to Chinatown, you know, but people didn't, the black restaurants were for black folks, and I never heard about any white southern restaurants. They had, I guess, you know, they had home cooking places, and but... I guess. I mean, I didn't know that white people talk Southern either, you know, until I went to Mississippi. I mean, until I went to New Orleans, you know, and I hear somebody, where you at, boo? And I'm thinking I'm going to talk, hey, see what's going on, meet some black folks. And anyway, I'll be 50 in the spring.
Houston, Lamarck, and also part of his family is from New Orleans. And so, you know, we had our own tradition. But I never thought until I moved away from Texas.
Way away from
Texas. I mean, of course I moved to Pennsylvania, and that's where I went to college. And then I moved to Ohio, because that's where I went to graduate school. And then I went to California before I moved to Paris. And all of that was a big education for me. But I remember when I lived in Texas that for me, soul food and Southern food were synonymous. And I, perhaps because of segregation, I mean, I come up in an era where there was a good deal of integration, but still there was segregation, no doubt. And so I didn't know a lot of white people outside of school, and I certainly didn't socialize with them outside of school, so I didn't know what they were eating at home. And what you see on television is what is the North and maybe the Midwest and, you know, California. So I had no media reflection of the South. And I thought that soul food was Southern food and only black people ate it.
I think soul food, the name, I think it came from when we came up there 50,000 at a time, we had to come to the church. And then, so everyone was going to church, and it was the church dinners. And I think that's where the name soul food came from, was church food.
Don't you think soul food could also be a political construct, too? I mean, it's, here I'm a white boy talking about this, but the idea that to rename the foods of past or perhaps privation and grab hold of it and call it something of your own. I mean, soul food.
I don't know when the name turned up.
At the same time, people chanted soul power.
Soul music.
Yeah, you never heard it before the 60s.
Right, because soul music.
Chant black power, then you have soul food.
I think soul music was when they first started having the church type music and mixing it with the popular, and then so anything black was soul. I don't know, somebody.
Yeah, you've already asked for Lois.
Well, wondering whether or not, after all this migration to Chicago, they had developed Chicago cuisine, something perhaps based on those foods.
They've distilled it.
And one thing I noticed is that in Mississippi and Tennessee, where folks came from, and they were doing barbecue and whole hog and shoulders, they didn't do ribs separately in the old tradition. And in Chicago, pretty much all you got was ribs.
It's a rib thing.
I wonder whether there's any other way in which this thing that is coming to Chicago would be based on the old cuisine.
Well, today, based on Army and Lou's menu, they've been at it longer than anyone, and they've got it pretty much down to catfish, fried chicken. They got oysters, perch, trout, scallops. Well, no, I guess I... you know, basically, there's just a few offerings that it comes down to, and I can't. We don't have a Chicago style gumbo or a Chicago style that I can think of. Chicago style catfish, it's just corn fried, but it's basically catfish and fried chicken that is ubiquitous. Yeah, on the north side now, you know, it's another. Yeah, years ago. But now there's like, you know, umpteen blues bars on the north side, and Junior Wells Legends is, you know, just downtown on the edge. And
Buddy Guy.
Buddy, that's what I meant. Buddy right Guy's right Legends.
Chef Jason Gerard's in the
back. Hey.
Yeah.
Please.
I have a question on as far as Chicago and ribs go and down south. I noticed I'm just touring as limited as I have my hammer. I just say a northern white boy.
Go ahead.
For a musician who came up from West Louisiana, an African American musician, Buddy Guy, who I think a lot of what I've seen as far as ribs, Chicago is the stockyards. The whole country, and they can process all that meat there. And I think that, you know, the ribs being, and probably, you know, being more syllable to the white community in Chicago, as far as very segregated city, you can take a look at it in its neighborhoods. Because my great grandparents, one came from Sicily, moved into the Taylor Street neighborhood, which we call a little bit right now. I had my other great grandparents who came from Germany, and they moved in, they opened restaurants up on the north side. Right now, I work in a blues club, which is Bell House Blues Camp, is the biggest blues club in the city. I ran into Soul Foodie to Cajun Creole. When I got there, my buddy had already been open for 7 years when I got there. I was there 11 years now. He was serving stuff like frozen pizza, euros, hot dogs, chicken sandwiches, and he wanted to redo the menu. What we've done is we've taken it, and if you look at some of the other Cajun restaurants in the city, I think. Rather than a bastardization of Southern cooking, what I think is you've got a lot of transplants, and I found this out when I came down here. They call it the diaspora down here, but up north we call it the Great Migration. And it's just that, you know, the culture moving from the South, when you consider the music, when you consider the people who came, how they got here, what they went through, to be perfect, I'm sorry, how they got there, I'm not sure. What they came through to get there, what, you know, what it really took to get up there. And it changed, it evolved. So when you look at Chicago soul food, when I look at Chicago soul food as a native Chicagoan who, you know, hasn't spent more than cumulatively 3 weeks in the South, I don't consider it bastardization, I guess, as much as an evolution. The ingredients that are available up north, you know, you might, I get andouille sausage, but my andouille sausage is, you know, heaven on seven, they ship their sausage up from the South. We get it. Made by a local company who made their living making Polish sausage. But now with, you see all the soul food in Chicago, and I mean, when I look at places like Glasses, I mean, that's, you know, that's soul food, man. I guess I always thought that Southern food as a kid was like Cracker Barrel. so, you know, growing up in Chicago, that's, I mean, but when you do, when you're on the South Side, you go to places like,
they're cooking from scratch at Glasses, yeah. They got the biscuit room. They got two biscuit ladies in there 24 hours a day.
Right. And, you know, and that's the way that it should be done. Now, not necessarily saying right on my menu.
That's why it's on the...
Soul Kitchen was one of the menus that you read. But you're seeing, I mean, and I hate to say the word fusion too, because, you know, but I think of it more as an evolution. And also I wanted to ask you, as far as, you know, the people who came up, what, they're about 2 million in total or more. That came up from the South during the diaspora. And what effect do you think they actually had on the cuisine of Chicago as a whole? Because the title of the talk, I think, it was Chicago, the southern, or the northernmost southern city. Because, honestly, I think there's a lot of southern influence in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, you come down here, and, you know, of course, I'm from the north, so... you might look at my food.
There's a lot of influence, but we're still outside the loop.
Oh.
I mean, you know, the grits are definitely optional. If they're not even, it's not even happening. I worked at the airport, and the last time I was in Chicago, the employees were so many employees, mostly black, at the airport, and we so compared to the string beans and smothered chicken or barbecue chicken dinner, like the real dinners, the meat and three type of dinner, we sold like 4,000 slices of pizza a day, and you can't count the mountains of hot dogs and hamburgers and chicken wings, and I'd sell like a dozen barbecue chicken with the choice of vegetables. And so the people that were working there, they ate like the tourists. And it's sad.
Okay, we have time for two more questions or comments. It was John Anderson and Rob. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Rob Klein, I just wanted to say something. I had to say something about the ribs. Because, Marvin, I know as you were reading through the menus, baby back ribs keeps coming up. And the lowest question is on ribs in Chicago. It's spare ribs, and it's spare ribs down here. Baby back ribs were invented for the food service trade when they started boning out loins. And whoever heard of a pork chop without a bone on it before, you know, 1990.
Well, the bone pays for the pork chop. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, it's just a point that
it's the way of the world.
But that's what you're going to get on those menus, not the spare ribs, which really were the southern barbecue.
And then John was next, then Bill, then Lewis.
Natalie and I were just sort of riffing off the same idea. Two things that I think are contributing here. One is critical mass. It's literally numbers of people make it possible for something to lift up and literally move to another place. And the power of segregation in all this is really profound. And I cite one example. Chicago is a more segregated city than Nashville right now. And one of the reasons for that is the numbers in the history contribute to this. Washington, D.C. is a southern city. Baltimore is a southern city, culinarily speaking. And you can go to a place like Nashville right now, and God knows I'm not saying Nashville is a wonderfully integrated, equitable place. Don't misunderstand. But you can go to Nashville, and you find that the real food of Nashville, the only stuff that's legitimately ours, is meat and threes. And the meat and threes are owned by blacks and whites. And the clientele is black and white. No matter where in the city you go, you couldn't go to Sweats on the north side and ever, ever expect not to see white people there. And you couldn't go to almost any place, even out in Belmead, Brentwood, in those places, and not find blacks there. If you go to a place like Jack Arnold's Country Kitchen, which is a few blocks south of downtown, I took a woman from National Public Radio there one time, and she accused me of setting the place up. And I brought all these people in as props because there's businessmen in front of these suits and guys in stock caps, you know, sock caps, all kinds of people sitting at the same table. The whole protocol is if you come into a restaurant that has tables for four, there are two people sitting at a table and there are not any other seats, you're supposed to offer those seats to whoever comes along. And the only time I ever saw someone seated refuse a seat to someone who wanted to sit down was when two white women, one seated, one with her plate in her hand, couldn't agree on whether the woman could sit down or not, and they got madder than hell. But other than that, it is just a different, whole different thing, and I don't understand what it is, but it's critical mass and migration.
So, you have a comment to?
I would like to ask a question about soul food and southern food. Like yourself, it was my experience that I didn't know southern whites ate soul food. And I didn't know that really until I started my company. But when I started my company, my rich white friends were black in the north. That she was starting a soul food company. Ha ha ha, that's marketing the chicken. That's the perception. And that all came about really in the, the 70s, when these universities started trying to have a soul food night and they really masterized the southern food. So our northern white friends really have a bad connotation on southern food. I think it's critical that we're going to export Southern cuisine to really stop the negative thinking of soul food, which African Americans do not have a negative feeling about soul food. It's important to them, as a matter of fact. And in fact, I wanted you to address this. And I think we should really do a better job of marketing our culture and really do a better job of saying that we too, Yankee food is not better than Southern food. The Midwestern food is not better than Southern.
We've got time for a couple more questions. Lewis, I think, has given his suggestion. Lewis just gave his text in line. He just, for some reason, I looked at him and he just looked at you.
I think we've got two or three different issues on the table, and I think they're all fascinating. The point about the segregated city, New York is a segregated city. And I think that one of the things that happens in the North that's fascinating is within the segregation of the cities, the domestic, if you will, segregation of the cities, we may all be on the street mixing and mingling at lunchtime, but at dinner time in New York, a restaurant in my neighborhood, which, first of all, there are no restaurants in my neighborhood. I live in Bedford Stuyvesant. There are no restaurants. There are about three restaurants. McDonald's, which is a serious old line, ladies wearing hankies like orchids, dressed in what to me is extremely evocative church lady, which is not the church lady you see on Saturday night, but it's the lady with the nurse's uniform, in the white nurse's uniform, with the white nurse's shoes. The uniform is too tight over the bust because the bust is ample, and there is a starch hanging that looks like an orchid, and that's McDonald's, and that's who's cooking. And they will, I don't know if Mr. Blanc was here, but honey, they'll talk to me about Jezebel.